everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Unauthorized Disclosure Podcast. I'm Kevin Gastola, joined by Rania Kalik. Hey, Rania.
Hey, Kevin.
We're very pleased this week to be joined by Andy Worthington, who is an investigative journalist, author, campaigner, and activist. He's based in the UK. You can find his work, his regular work, on Guantanamo at andyworthington.co.uk. It's a wonderful updated site that he keeps running, and he's also the co-founder of Close Guantanamo. Welcome to the show, Andy.
Yeah, hi. Good to be here.
Well, let's begin. We want to get to the testimony that made headlines around the world this past week at Guantanamo with one of the torture architects, James Mitchell, testifying and talking about his role in the torture and abuse of a detainee. But first, every January, unfortunately, because Guantanamo has not been closed, you make a trip from the UK to the US and you put on an action in DC to call attention to the fact that Guantanamo is still open. Why don't you talk about this work and what it's like under President Donald Trump? I suppose we can preface quite clearly here that it was not successfully closed by President Barack Obama, which means that President Donald Trump can do whatever he would like with the remaining prisoners as well as the facility. So that's the backdrop for any campaign to try and close Guantanamo down now.
Sure. Well, that's a very good point that you just made as well there, Kevin. I've been coming to the US in January because the anniversary of the opening of Guantanamo is on January the 11th. This is my 10th year, so I've been coming since 2011. And, you know, there have been some bad years along the way. There were bad years along the way under President Obama when it really seemed that nothing was happening. But I would say we've reached a new low point over the last 3 years since Donald Trump became president, because as you mentioned, he was handed over Guantanamo, and it turns out that whoever has control of Guantanamo can do what they want with it. And if you're Donald Trump, that means that before you are actually even inaugurated, you can tweet, because that's how the US government seems to be run these days. You can tweet, there must be no more releases from Gitmo, and then you can remain true to your word. That requires the support, of course, of Congress. But when we look at what's actually been happening with Guantanamo and congressional obstruction from Republicans, which has been going on since the first midterm elections in Obama's first presidency, when he lost control of the Congress, they completely back the obstruction to anything resembling the prison's closure from the president. So under Donald Trump, we've got this perfect situation as far as the Republicans are concerned, where the prison is sealed shut. Entombing the men remaining, I would say, was an accurate word. Entombing them in this pointless and cruel facility, which defies American values, where prisoners for the most part are held without charge or trial, and where they're kind of warehoused here now awaiting death, whenever that may come, 10, 20, 30, 40 years from now. And let's just repeat that, never being charged or tried for the most part. Most of these men will just be held there forever unless there's a significant change of leadership. So, you know, that's in a nutshell why I think that it's absolutely crucial that people who care keep shining a light on Guantanamo. And, you know, it really is understandable, of course, that with all the other crimes being perpetrated by Donald Trump, Guantanamo can get overlooked. But there is something extremely fundamental about the worry that should be attached to the continued existence of Guantanamo, not just on a you know, on a human basis, that these are actually human beings, although they were successfully dehumanized from the moment the Bush administration opened the prison and set about doing that. But the principles at stake are, you know, are enormously significant for Americans and for people around the world who think that our countries are ruled by the rule of law. What happened at Guantanamo, although there's a kind of thin veil of legality, is that it's a fundamentally lawless place. If men held there 18 years after it opened can be held at the whim of the president of the United States, somebody like Donald Trump, and really cannot be released by any legal mechanism, no pressure can be exerted from any source that can change Trump's mind or that of Congress, then we're dealing with the kind of facility that we should recognize as being akin to a facility that would be run by a dictatorship. And if the United States would like to admit that, then maybe we could start dealing with it, but they don't. So I think that's the fundamental problem. And why I keep coming every year, and why, you know, why there is something particularly bleak and dark about the existence of this prison right now.
And for people who are unfamiliar with your work, you've spent, you know, more than a decade. You can tell me if I'm wrong. It seems like since Guantanamo's been open, you've paid some attention to it. Am I right?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I think outside of the US, people were generally more aware right from the very beginning that something didn't look right about Guantanamo. Those initial images of the orange men hooded with their eyes covered, their ears covered, their mouths covered, cowering on the gravel, you know, really didn't strike people around the world very well. But I know that in the US it played slightly differently. People were caught up in the heat of what I characterize as primarily the desire for vengeance after 9/11. And also orange jumpsuits are actually familiar from the US domestic prison system. So it didn't look as shocking as it did to the rest of the world. But I followed things, Kevin, but I wasn't on the story on a full-time basis until really the fall of 2005 and very particularly early 2006, which is when I began working absolutely full-time on Guantanamo. And I actually, you know, worked flat out really for the first 5 years on it, you know, slightly to the detriment of my health at the end of those 5 years. But what I particularly was able to do, what I was placed to do, was my research coincided with the Pentagon losing a Freedom of Information lawsuit and being compelled to release the names and nationalities of the prisoners, which, you know, it hadn't done 4 years after the prison opened. The world hadn't been told who was being held there. And in some cases, if the International Committee of the Red Cross, which is the only outside body allowed to visit prisoners, if they hadn't somehow been able to get in touch with family members, then, you know, the prisoners were the prisoners' whereabouts were unknown even to, you know, their own relatives. What also was ordered released was supporting documentation. And so these were the unclassified allegations against the prisoners, and thousands of pages of supporting documentation, which were primarily transcripts from tribunals and review boards that had taken place at Guantanamo, an administrative process that was designed to look as though it had some kind of legal standing, but actually didn't. So it was designed to rubber stamp the men's designation on capture as enemy combatants, as people without fundamental human rights, which was what the Bush administration had intended. The men weren't allowed legal representation. They weren't allowed to see or hear anything about the classified information against them. And yet these documents contained all kinds of responses from the men to the allegations that were put against them when they could make sense of them. A lot of the time they had simply no idea what was going on and were very quickly rubber stamped as being the enemy combatants that the administration claimed they were all along. You know, these were men captured without rights, not screened adequately at all to assess whether they had the right people. And then sent to Guantanamo. And so from that, I was able to, with a lot of cross-referencing and analysis, able to build up a coherent analysis of who the men in Guantanamo were, involving key aspects like where they were actually captured. The US said they were captured on the battlefield. I was to say it's safe to say that no one was captured on the battlefield. Men were bought for bounties from the US's Afghan and Pakistani allies. And so I was able to work out some were caught in Afghanistan, some in Pakistan in a whole series of dreadfully incompetent house raids that took place there in 2002. Many hundreds of the prisoners, the largest group, were captured crossing from Afghanistan into Pakistan at the end of 2001. All typified as Al-Qaeda and Taliban by the administration, but civilians were also fleeing the horrors of an Afghanistan being destroyed by the US-led invasion. So that's not entirely true. And then there was a group of about 40 men who had been through the black sites, or their slightly lesser-known counterpart, which is a number of torture prisons in other countries that where the US sent men to be tortured on their behalf. But the black sites that we're all most familiar with are the ones, the network around the world that was directly run by the CIA. And so those men as well ended up at Guantanamo. And that's really the kind of key story of who was held there, the mistakes that were made. And, you know, time has only reinforced those convictions that something terribly wrong happened at Guantanamo and is still happening at Guantanamo. And the release of the classified military files by WikiLeaks in 2011 was another component in, I think, establishing the extent to which things had gone wrong, as those files named the people who were making allegations against their fellow prisoners. And a terrible pattern emerged in these files of prisoners repeatedly lying about their fellow prisoners, but having what they said treated as accurate by the authorities, who were desperate to justify the reason that they'd rounded up these people in a fundamentally random manner in the first place.
And you know, I'm glad you gave that background. I just wanted to kind of make a comment and get your take on this. But you know, I have a 15-year-old nephew, and yeah. I was visiting it for the holidays a couple weeks ago. And I was struck by the fact that the word Guantanamo came up. I can't remember the context, like in a conversation with my sisters. And he was like, what's Guantanamo?
Right.
And that's no, but it's just, I mean, it's been 18 years. Is that right? 18 years?
Yeah, it has.
And that's like an adult. That's like an adult, a whole, like someone raised an adult in that time. And there's like a whole generation of people that just don't even know this place exists. Or yeah. If they've heard the word, maybe they've heard like a popular culture kind of reference, but they don't really know what it means. Yep. I guess I don't know. What's your take on that? Because that just really, it's kind of jarring for me when I think about that.
Well, it's very shocking, isn't it? And another aspect of the story, which I think is important, is that President Obama said that he would close it, and he then didn't. But, you know, you'd be amazed how many people you meet who think that he closed it because he said he would. And that, I think, is a very telling aspect of modern day politics, is that politicians actually have all realized that if they say something, a lot of people are so uncurious that they take it as being true. So we've moved into an era where politicians don't have to actually deliver on what they say. They just have to say it in the first place. And we're in some kind of Wizard of Oz world where apparently it's true. The point that you make about people, you know, being too young to have been born when 9/11 happened and when Guantanamo opened is, I think, you know, very significant. And it's troubling that that so many people are not getting any information at all about it. I mean, I've actually done some events here in the UK where I've been amazed at how engaged young people who weren't born when the prison opened have been about it. But I think there's quite a process of politicization amongst young people taking place in the UK at the moment. And I would have to sadly conclude that that's not as true in the United States. And of course, you know, the media has a huge role to play in having not informed US citizens in many cases at all about anything truthful about Guantanamo. Having just been there for my, you know, annual 1.5 week visit, then, you know, I kind of look around at who's doing what. And, you know, the presence of Fox News in the American media is a really genuinely troubling thing, something that we don't fully have a counterpart for in the British broadcast media, somewhere that relentlessly pumps out lies and distortions, and that over the time that Guantanamo has been open has done the same thing for Guantanamo. So, you know, but also there is no regular mention of Guantanamo in the media as a whole. And I would say that there are certain things that I would love it if the media recognized that if a chronic injustice takes place, maybe it's something that should be remarked upon on a regular basis. And what I'm particularly thinking about is that when Piers Morgan was the editor of the Daily Mirror at the time of the illegal U.S. invasion of Iraq, he printed a WMDometer on the front page of that newspaper every day, counting how many days weapons of mass destruction hadn't been found in Iraq, because that was the spurious justification for the illegal invasion. And that was, I rarely have good things to say about Piers Morgan. And he was eventually sacked from that job for faking photos of prisoner abuse, which was a terrible thing to have done. But in terms of this clock that he set up counting on the front page of a prominent British newspaper every day, I think that was very powerful. And I think the notion of the objective liberal media that they don't campaign on anything, and what they do is present both sides of the story to people and let them make their own minds up, is one that has abjectly failed during our lifetimes and is actually leading to the terrible positions that we're in, where the right wing, who lie and don't care, are working not just through traditional media but also online to bend the minds of as many people as possible towards their really repugnant worldview, which we're all suffering from.
Let me ask you, as you say, there's very limited attention in the press. When headlines come, even as they are significant developments, mostly we shrug and don't spend that much time talking to them. I have done some limited reporting in the past few years, but it usually comes with news that the ACLU has filed another lawsuit, or the Center for Constitutional Rights has filed another lawsuit, or sometimes we get alarming developments related to what the Trump administration is claiming as well. I'll just throw out a couple developments that have happened, and then I want to hear your thoughts on what you think is the some of the more remarkable developments under President Donald Trump, so people can be brought up to speed and we can address this gap in knowledge. Because going from the end of Obama's presidency to now, I think most people have not a clue what's been unfolding with this facility. But first, a few things I would remember is the Supreme Court rejecting a one captive's case when he challenged his perpetual detention, even though the war on terrorism has absolutely no end in sight. And essentially, the Supreme Court decided that they weren't going to resolve this question. So we have forever prisoners in Guantanamo, and that is allowed. We've also seen the Trump administration arguing it may detain these captives at Guantanamo until fighting stops in Afghanistan. We don't know when that's going to be. But we also know that under Obama, we had a similar kind of argument put forward around Yemen, and that people who were from Yemen, those prisoners, could not be released back to their own home country until the U.S.-backed Saudi-led coalition stopped bombing there. So those are a couple, I think, significant developments in the last 3 years. Andy, what would you add so people could understand the Trump administration's policy in the last few years?
Well, you know, absolutely, Kevin, those are some good examples. And actually, that Supreme Court case that you mentioned, the one that was last June, involved a note being attached by Justice Breyer. He didn't disagree with the court's refusal to take the case. They haven't taken a Guantanamo case since 2008, when they granted the prisoners constitutionally guaranteed habeas corpus rights, which led to the only golden period for the law in the prison's history, when dozens of prisoners were ordered released by judges because the government had insufficient evidence. But those, the basis of those rulings was then overturned by malignant, politically motivated judges in the appeals court, who kept imposing ruling after ruling that prevented anyone from successfully gaining a habeas corpus petition granted to secure their release. That's a, you know, a horrible, cynical story that a lot of people don't know. But the Supreme Court has refused persistently to take back control of detention issues as far as the law is concerned, and has left it with these wretched judges' rulings from 2010 and 2011 that gutted habeas corpus of all meaning for the prisoners. So that's a, you know, that's a big legal problem that no one wants to address. And Justice Breyer, in his note, said, you know, when we approved imprisonment for these men, which was back in 2004, basically the Bush administration had set up Congress had authorized the authorization for use of military force, which allowed the president to go after people that he thought were associated with 9/11, Al-Qaeda and the Taliban. And the Supreme Court in June 2004 ruled that those people that he captured could be held until the end of hostilities, and that they were held at Guantanamo. So there's the legal framework for Guantanamo. One obvious problem from that from the beginning is that there was a thing called the Geneva Conventions, which allowed countries to imprison people until the end of hostilities. So the Supreme Court had effectively, rather meaninglessly or rather troublingly, established a parallel American version of the Geneva Conventions. But the problem over time has been that the end of hostilities has never surfaced and shows no sign of ever doing. And what Justice Breyer did in his little note was to say, I think that we may have inadvertently ended up authorizing, you know, perpetual detention, which wasn't what we had in mind, and kind of threw this out into the ether to see whether any of the other justices would in future years take that up and run with it. Given the, you know, more right-wing leaning aspect of the court, I'm not sure that we should expect that to happen. So we're looking at a position where the prisoners have been fundamentally abandoned by the courts in the same way that they've been abandoned by Congress and by the president. So, you know, that's why I talk about how Guantanamo is a prison that has been sealed shut. They are... The men held there are, if you like, the personal prisoners of Donald Trump. We could call them political prisoners. Certainly, Congress every year insists on imposing restrictions on anyone being transferred to the U.S. mainland for any reason. A huge list of restrictions on countries that the prisoners could be sent to if there was a president who wanted to release them, an absolute ban on funds to create a new facility on or take over a facility on the U.S. mainland where men could be moved so the prison at Guantanamo could be closed, a complete ban on any negotiation with Cuba about returning the base to them. So there's a total lockdown on doing anything about Guantanamo. And as we're in an election year, then the interesting thing is that since the Democrats retook the House of Representatives in the midterm elections, there is some movement there, and particularly in the various committees, and particularly the House Armed Services Committees. There are Democrats who are interested in putting Guantanamo and its closure back on the table. I think I can say that in all sincerity. So the question is, how will things go this year? If the Democrats were at least to take back Congress, then I think we would have some movement. But of course, we don't know what's going to happen. The worst thing for Guantanamo would be another 4 years of Trump and Republican control of of Congress, at least of the Senate, as it is now. In which case, I don't see how anything is going to happen on Guantanamo unless unless foreign countries somehow got together to make a big deal about it. I can't see that happening, and nor can, frankly, can I see Donald Trump caring. So, you know, that's all quite alarming, I think, really. And, you know, the only glimmer of light there has been is that there was a case that was won by one of the prisoners last year about, which nobody heard about. This wasn't even reported. I think I was the only person who reported it. That his habeas corpus rights, his due process rights had basically been infringed by these appeals court decisions I was talking about. The intention was to get the appeals court in DC to actually have a full hearing and deal with it themselves. But instead, they threw it back to the lower court and suggested that the case should be looked at again, because maybe there was a problem with the extent to which due process had been denied from the prisoners, all of which gets very technical. I think it's very hard for lay people to get a full grasp of this. But it could be significant, but it's gone back to the lower court, and it's quite an aged judge who's responsible for dealing with it. And nothing is happening. So whether we'll hear anything about that in due course, I don't know. But it seems like we're in a terrible mess where Guantanamo has almost entirely disappeared from view, and the prisoners have been failed by every branch of the United States government, and it's difficult to see how we can refocus on them in a way that would alert the American people, wake them up to what's actually happening.
Well, I have just a couple of questions for you before we wrap. It's definitely worth noting that the number of prisoners at Guantanamo right now is 40. In fact, for people who aren't aware, there's only been one prisoner who was released while President Donald Trump has been in office. And then meanwhile, in the last week, we saw this reporting and coverage of a military tribunal hearing at Guantanamo where a CIA torture architect, one of them, James Mitchell, testified in this proceeding. And it related to Abu Zubaydah and the role he played in the torture of this detainee. And he claims, I'm just going to read a little part of this because it's rather chilling, that apparently his CIA supervisors had cabled him to say something like, please continue with the aggressive interrogation strategy for the next 2 to 3 weeks, even though he himself started to feel like it might be time to stop waterboarding or engaging in these torture techniques. It seems that apparently those directing this operation had derided the psychologists like him as quote-unquote pussies, and that they believed that that Mr. Zubaydah could yield some information about what they feared were looming terrorist attacks. And so with this support, he basically continued on with engaging in this torture. Now, it's worth mentioning that within the last year, James Mitchell has been represented in popular culture. There was a film put together called The Report about the CIA torture report that was drafted, and Douglas Hodge is the actor, a British actor, I believe, who portrays James Mitchell in this film. So the public at large has had some introduction to this story. This film is rather good. It doesn't mince when it comes to depicting the brutality. You know, and now we have Mitchell saying this. What do you think about what Mitchell's saying? It sounds like he might be covering his own skin, but at the same time, you know, maybe there is something to the fact that superiors wanted him to keep pressing on.
Well, absolutely. He must be, protecting himself on some basis. I mean, we know that, you know, in complete contrast to what he's saying, this was a program that him and his colleague Bruce Jessen designed by reverse engineering the training they gave to US personnel if they were captured by a hostile enemy who wanted to torture them. You know, and they were paid $81 million for doing so. So they were driving it in some way. But clearly, you know, this is an interesting twist. What we've actually heard before is that there were people within the CIA who were absolutely appalled by what they were either witnessing or were required to take part in. And I think that's something that needs not to be forgotten. But yeah, here we've got a kind of new angle of Mitchell trying to say that even when he thought things had gone too far, then you know, his bosses wouldn't let him stop. So it's hard to see anyone emerging from this without them all being tainted by the horrors of what they did, and you know, and all of them should really be held accountable for what are our crimes. We've had a lot of spin about how it was enhanced interrogation. It was torture. Torture is a crime under US law, and so you know, we've still failed to have that addressed properly. And it's a very interesting approach to how things are happening in the ongoing and never-ending pretrial hearings in the military commissions, that the team of Ammar al-Baluchi, one of the five men accused of involvement in the 9/11 attacks, have come up with this angle. And you know, the military commissions is a broken system. It's it was dragged out of the history books by Dick Cheney. Congress ruled it illegal. Obama brought it back. It is full of holes like a Swiss cheese. It doesn't work. But the fundamental problem with it is that the defense teams are trying to establish the truth about the horrendous torture their clients were subjected to, while the prosecution teams are trying to do exactly the opposite and hide that information. And so they go round and round and round. Thinking about Mitchell and Jessen and Mitchell's testimony and the presence, you know, there are more journalists at Guantanamo this week than there have been in years. I was, you know, coming back from the States, and I haven't had the chance to look at everything yet. I would hope, but I don't expect, that these people would, while in Guantanamo, reflect on the fact that really not at all very far from where they are in the courtroom and where they're staying, 40 men are still held. And as I said, for the most part, without charge or trial, only 9 of the 40 are involved in pretrial hearings or have been convicted. And they were kept in two facilities. So some of the men are alleged high-value detainees, many of whom are not facing trials. And a man like Abu Zubaydah, who was horrendously tortured and who was not, as the U.S. claimed that he was, the number 3 in al-Qaeda. He wasn't in al-Qaeda at all. And then we've got the lower value detainees who are kept in a separate facility and who are the ones who, you know, no one is suggesting will ever be put on trial, and the ones who the Bush administration and the Obama administration and now the Trump administration has been content to hold forever without charge or trial. And it's so infrequent to have a massive media focus on Guantanamo. If the people who are there are failing to make the connection that not just some of the men held at Guantanamo went through this torture program, but that there is something very fundamentally wrong with the entire existence of the prison at Guantanamo and the men who are held there. If they don't focus on these lower value detainees who didn't go through the torture program, but who have been tortured and abused in their own way, then I think yet again we're seeing the failure of the mainstream media to do what it is required to do, which is to report on terrible things that are being done by their governments and to shine a light on that to try and get the world to pay attention. So, you know, as I say, I haven't had the chance yet to read everything that's been going on, Kevin. I appreciate how much focus there has been on these terrible accounts of Mitchell and what he was told to do and what he was doing. But I really hope that the media doesn't just move on when these hearings are over, although I fear that they will.
Well, I have one more slightly unrelated question, but an important one that I want to get your viewpoint on. It is worth emphasizing, however, that there was a major settlement that was issued in 2017 in a case brought by the ACLU, and it's entirely confidential. We really don't know what Mitchell or Jessen agreed to admit or concede to as far as the settlement goes. But remember, they were indemnified and did not have to face damages. Our own government was going to pay for whatever liability they incurred from the torture and abuse for which they were responsible. So, yeah. And, you know, we'll follow up in the future with more details on this as it continues to have impacts at Guantanamo. I'm sure James Mitchell will likely be called in for future cases as a witness that the defense attorneys could use to press their case about how these prisoners were tortured. The last thing I want to ask you about, just because you're in the UK and also you worked with the Guantanamo files that were disclosed by WikiLeaks, do you have any thoughts about what's happening in the UK with Julian Assange at this moment, and any light you would care to share on what goes down at Her Majesty's prison, Belmarsh? I know that there's been some representation in your own local press before that this is kind of like a British Guantanamo to some extent.
Well, yeah, Belmarsh is a maximum security prison, so that's where, you know, pretty serious convicted prisoners are held. But it has also, you know, since the war on terror began, been somewhere that that the UK government likes to hold Muslims accused of terrorism. We had our own for a time. We had our own system under Tony Blair where foreign prisoners and some British-born prisoners were held for years without charge or trial on the basis of secret evidence. And Belmarsh was one of those places. And Julian Assange being held there seems to me deeply inappropriate, as he's not alleged to have committed any kind of violence. So he's held there, it seems to me, on the part of the British as intended to be noticed as a high-level, you know, political prisoner. I think that that everyone around the world needs to be very worried about the actions of both the United States government and the British government when it comes to Julian Assange. What was leaked to Julian Assange was by Chelsea Manning, all of those documents. Chelsea Manning was tried and convicted for that, and then, you know, fortunately had her sentence commuted by President Obama, although she's now imprisoned again because she won't cooperate with the grand jury investigation into Julian Assange. But Assange's role in this was a publisher. The analogy that I think that everyone should keep very close to their hearts is Daniel Ellsberg and the Pentagon Papers and the Washington Post. WikiLeaks functioned as a publisher like the Washington Post, like the New York Times, like the Guardian, taking material that had been disclosed because it was in the public interest, showing wrongdoing at the highest level by our governments and making that available. For the US to want to extradite him to face espionage charges is an absolute disgrace. It sends out a really chilling signal about the freedom of the press that everyone should be alarmed by. And the fact that the British government and Sajid Javid, the minister particularly responsible, have rubber stamped this, shows the extent to which the British government has also failed completely in its responsibilities to uphold press freedom. I think we all have reason to be worried about the circumstances in which Mr. Assange is being held and his health. There is, I think, going to be a fairly long process. There's a full extradition hearing that's supposed to be beginning next month. I think that could roll on. Let's say that's granted, then it will be challenged and it will go through, go to the appeals court and then go up to the Supreme Court, as with the US. I think that at this point, pressure absolutely needs to be exerted from around the world on the British government to say that what they're doing is unacceptable. And I would hope that, you know, that Maybe at some point there will be someone in high positions in the UK who's more amenable to that before it actually comes to pass that he is sent to the US, which shouldn't happen. So thanks for asking that. I'm going to be trying to pay some attention to what's happening next month, and I hope there'll be a flurry of global media attention on that as well in the UK, because it really is an extremely significant case.
Well, I intend to be contributing to that global media attention. I'm going to be making a trip to London in February to cover this extradition hearing, and I've already made plans.
Let me know when you're here. We can meet up, yeah?
So let's sign off, and I want to thank you, Andy, for joining the show. And once again, you can find Andy's work at andyworthington.co.uk. And he's regularly reporting on Guantanamo, one of the only journalists who is documenting all aspects of Guantanamo regularly. And thanks again, Andy.
Okay, thanks, Kevin and Aranya. It's been great talking to you. Thanks a lot.
Again, thank you to all of our patrons who support our podcast and make it possible week to week. If you are not a patron of the Unauthorized Disclosure podcast, we highly encourage you to go to patreon.com/unauthorizeddisclosure. There you'll be able to get early access to our episodes, along with access to exclusive content, including content that we posted this week. Again, you can go to patreon.com/unauthorizeddisclosure and become a patron now. Thank you.